Welcome back to the Unhinged History Podcast with your unhinged host, Tani Caesar. Me, today you're being treated to a pillow talk episode. Why? The reason is because I just had surgery, okay? But whatever they can do, I can do bleeding. We are pressing on. And not only is today just me, nay, it's an interview with one of my friends. Yes, that's right. I consider him a good friend of mine, Dr. Southerton. And we'll introduce him shortly, but we're going to be talking about DNA. He's a DNA scientist, and I want to encapsulate the things that he knows and put them in your brain, because that's what I do. We're going to talk about, like, what is DNA? How does one study it? Why is it so important? Why has it become more and more and more of an exact science over the years? All the things. So if that sounds like fun to you, please stick around, subscribe, follow, whatever, and let's cue the music. Let the games begin. Oh, you thought because I just had so... No, this is how this begins, okay? Well, firstly, I'd like to thank you vehemently for your ratings and reviews. I am humbled and aghast. Today, I would like to read you two reviews from the Apple Podcast reviews. This one's from Grumpy Sugar Cakes. Love the username. 100% obsessed, 5-star review, thank you. May the goddess bless you. An amazing podcast from a hilarious, intelligent, beautiful, amazing woman. Hilarious. I can't wait for more episodes to be dropped. Love heart, love heart, love heart, love heart. Thank you, Grumpy Super Cakes. And the second review is from Marie Claire. Another 5-star brilliance is the title. Adore it. This, a new take, fresh take on this genre. I grew up watching History Channel religiously. This is my new obsession. Thank you, Tani. Truly brilliant. I adore that. So I appreciate that an OG girly, you know, one of us. And as always, there is on my jewelry company. The thing is that I have a history-based jewelry business, right? And today we're talking about DNA. So every time I do a podcast episode, I like to have like an adjacent like discount deal. But like DNA kind of encapsulates everything now, doesn't it? So the deal in which we're going to do is kind of a store-wide deal because like all the things. I don't know if that makes sense, but you can get 20% off your order by using the code DNA. Just 20% off. Doesn't really matter what. Earrings, anything. 20% off. I didn't run this past my financial team beforehand, so I might get into trouble later. Oh well, it's out there now. DNA for 20% off. Yeah, so welcome to Dr. Southerton. I am so pleased to have it. I'm actually fangirling a little bit to have you on the podcast. Dr. Southerton is a prominent scientist, and the way that we met actually is via the LDS community. So he has extensive research and knowledge and just treasure trove of interesting facts in DNA and genetics, and particularly in various genetic evidence that's disproved a bunch of things that any exmos that are listening probably, you know him, you're geeking out with me. So you're an author, losing a lost tribe. Yep. Of Native Americans' DNA in the Mormon Church. We became connected because we were both on the Mormon Stories podcast. Thank you to John DeLynn. We love you for connecting us. And here we are. So that was probably a terrible intro, but Simon, I'll let you kind of introduce your career and your pathway and how do we get here?
I'm not actually a human geneticist.
Interesting.
My background is trees, forest trees. In fact, I worked at CSIRO in Australia, which is Australia's sort of national research organization. And believe it or not, trees and humans are not all that different at the DNA level for various reasons, but there's a lot of similarity in many of our genes, even between humans and plants. Trees are also live in very large populations like humans, and they're randomly mating, which is like humans. Unlike many other plants, eucalypts, which I studied mostly, they only pollinate and mate between very close by trees.
Sure.
Their pollen doesn't go all around, blown all over the place.
Yeah, to bananas and things like that. Like, yeah.
But as you mentioned, I did get very interested in human DNA quite a long time ago, back in about 1998, last century.
I would have been two. I was 2 years old.
You exist. You did exist.
Okay. I existed.
Well, so as a Mormon, and as you would know, I believed that before Columbus reached America, that there had been Jews who had sailed to America.
Uh-huh.
They had built civilizations in America, and their descendants are among the ancestors of the American Indians. Now, I can pretty much sum up the last 30 to 40 years of genetic research on American Indians with one statement, and that is that not a single mainstream scientist in America that's worked on them believes there's any evidence of Jews in the pre-Columbian ancestry of American Indians.
Which is a humongous statement, because we are, I guess, as far as I understand it, we're a melting pot of various, like, DNA, you know, like, interbreeding. So, like, when there's conclusive evidence that absolutely no indicators are there, that's pretty conclusive.
Yeah. Well, the technology is just so amazingly sensitive these days. DNA, the unique thing about DNA is that it's not the molecule which is passed from generation to generation that's important. It's the information that it has. The DNA is comprised of four repeating units. They're known by the letters A, C, G, and T. We won't go into what those are. But it's the arrangement of those letters in DNA that drives and guides the direction of all of the functions of our bodies. So the DNA encodes for genes. So genes that are within our DNA. And they code for, each gene codes for a protein, and that protein will have a unique function. And then quite a lot of them have a very, very different functions. It's quite complex, but I think humans have about 20 to 30,000 genes. And also variants of those genes. So there's all sorts of other modifications the bodies can make. So it's even quite a bit more complex than that. But humans have around about 3 billion letters of DNA. One of the most fascinating things when it comes to looking at the ancestry of humans, we're going to talk a bit about, is that when we pass our genes on, all of our 3 billion letters of DNA, when we pass that on to our offspring, obviously in partnership with a husband or wife, each parent passes on half of the complement of the DNA.
Yeah.
When we do that, little errors creep in. So out of that 3 billion letters that are there, something in the order of 20 to 30 new mistakes occur in the DNA.
Right. Interesting.
And that's a completely random process. In most cases. And that information is the raw material of evolution. So all organisms that occur, all living organisms, plants and animals, fungi, whatever, they all have DNA.
Got it.
And as they pass it on in each generation, then
things morph.
Yeah, it's because to copy the DNA is a huge undertaking for an organism. There are a lot of genes involved in copying the DNA. And they don't get it right all the time.
I've made two children myself, and I will tell you, it is not an easy task. No, it just took a lot of effort. So, you know, copying DNA is not a copy and paste. It's like a 10-month, possibly 2-year-long traumatic experience. Anyway, that's a side note.
It's very complex. Maybe it's traumatic for an enzyme process in our body. Anyway, so all these random errors can sometimes be very problematic, because we'll have lethal diseases or problems that can arise if a protein, a gene is misspells the instructions to make an enzyme.
Got it.
But there are also many of them, the vast majority of them, relatively harmless or benign.
Interesting.
So But for a geneticist who's looking at comparing different human populations, for example, that's extremely valuable information because it is carried on, because if it was not harmful to the organism, it's carried on in the descendants.
So it lays dormant there, really.
Just sits in the background because
one day,
way down the track, and this is with all living organisms, one of those particular spelling changes in the DNA might
be useful.
Advantage. It might be useful.
Yeah, interesting.
And that will then, that's where evolution occurs. Evolution is not a random process. Evolution, the creation of the variation is random.
Mm-hmm.
Evolution, if all of a sudden one particular mutation is very useful, then evolution will slip very heavily. Then it's a very directed process, if you like.
Yeah. That makes sense. Like as if the genetic coding, I suppose, is like, hey, we're useful now. Let's just heighten this aspect to survive or whatever. I guess, are we survival mechanisms at a root? I suppose, like, that all comes into it.
We did some work in eucalyptus on some of the disease resistance genes.
Uh-huh.
Plants get attacked by different fungi.
Yeah.
And eucalyptus have just hundreds and hundreds of slightly different variants of all of these genes which recognize fungi that attack them.
Interesting.
Some of those genes can just sit there for ages and ages and ages, not really do anything. But then when a fungus comes along,
they're like, whoops.
That it's important to recognize.
It all
becomes really important. So it's very useful to have lots of variation hanging around there in things like disease resistance gene.
Interesting. I just did an episode called The Banana Boys, which was talking about bananas, and I guess a similar concept where most of the bananas, other than the Cavendish banana that was like sort of attacked by this fungus, but it wiped out so much of the population of the bananas.
So that's a really interesting, and it's very closely related to what we're talking about, because a lot of crops, and banana is a classic, is
really
they're clonal. So the entire population is genetically identical. So a lot of the wheat fields that you look at, particularly in Australia, there's huge areas of wheat around Australia, many of those are genetically identical.
Which is terrible if a fungus comes around where the genetic coding doesn't have a defense mechanism to pull out. Interesting.
So that is always with what they call monocultures using clonal material. So breeders always in wheat breeding, they're always keeping an eye on an issue there. So they will be trying to get an early heads up as to what fungi might be around the corner.
Interesting.
Tested varieties that are ready in the wings to come in. So
fungi is fascinating in and of itself. But to move forward, this is obviously a history podcast. My interest is, are you able to sort of give us a really quick rundown of where, I guess, DNA science started and how far we've come, in the sense that I constantly get troll messages like, oh, carbon dating can't be trusted, all this rubbish, except people are, I guess, running off assumptions that were apparent maybe back in, I don't know, 100 years ago. I guess, can you give us the rundown of where we've come from and where we are now?
Carbon dating obviously is for people who believe that we all descend from Adam and Eve, who lived 7,000 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
Carbon dating is very challenging to those beliefs. And so naturally, there are many, many people who attack carbon dating, because carbon dating is very good for dating things in the last 50 to 60,000 years. Now, any technology is only as good as the people who use it and how careful they are with it.
Got it.
And you can find there'll be scientists who will use their skills to find holes in carbon dating, but there is,
yeah,
I can assure you there's a huge global community of scientists who understand carbon dating extremely well. And if you are careful with your analysis, carbon dating can be extremely accurate. And some of the ways that they've been able to fine-tune and make it more accurate is, like, carbon dating used to be mostly done by isolating pieces of timber that carried carbon in them.
Okay. Yeah.
As the technology has advanced, scientists can now isolate DNA from all of the tree rings. Tree ring analysis goes back several thousand years, and that's enabled scientists to improve the calibrations that are made with carbon dating. Another really fascinating one is that stalactites in caves. In some caves, there is an annual change in the iron deposited in the stalagmite. You can imagine in dry periods, the water coming through is more sort of rusty, more brown. Or heavy rain periods, it's clearer. And so you get these rings in the stalagmite. And some of these go back tens of thousands of years.
Yeah.
Scientists are able to isolate the carbon from each ring in the stalagmite. And they're using that to tighten up
the timings that are
to get very accurate carbon dating.
Wow. So interesting.
Scientists are very, I mean, if you're sloppy, for example, if you are carbon dating a piece of charcoal that's in the ground and there's a young tree root that's growing through the charcoal, that tree root would have been produced in the last 50 years and that will contaminate the carbon in charcoal, right?
Got it. Yeah.
That's one thing. But there are many, many other ways. Again, another very common source of contamination is rainwater. So rainwater is dilute calcium carbonate.
Sure.
It's a dilute carbonic acid. So the rainwater will run down through the soil and that young carbon can get attached to
oak.
Yeah. So a good scientist will be aware of all these particular problems and they will
mitigate
to get around it. So you can rest assured that if in the hands of a good scientist, and I would say in most of our top scientific publications, if there's carbon dating that's been done, it's likely to be fairly accurate. So I think it's
very interesting
technology. So
and not to mention, is it 70 other forms of dating, inclusive of uranium, inclusive of luminescence dating, inclusive of, I can't remember the rest. They're the two that just come to mind.
There's about 70, I can't remember why.
Yeah, I've made friends with a fair few archaeologists that are like, yeah, we don't really use carbon much because, you know, it's not far back enough for us. We need uranium that's got a half-life of 4 billion years, you know. Obviously, my question here is, I guess it is important to note that you said the scientist is as good as the scientist is, but a lot of scientific studies are funded by private entities, and that's probably important to, like, just speak on slightly, because if you get a scientist that's funded by a particular organization that has to prove that this is not true, then I guess that becomes bias, and that's important. Just for learning's sake, it's important to look at who has funded the study.
Yeah.
You
know, not too much of an issue when we're talking about human origins and...
Got it.
Because it's generally not funded...
Well...
...that's got any skin in it. It's not like the tobacco companies.
Yeah. Like,
we should find out if nicotine's addictive or...
Yeah.
Is bad for you. Oh, they couldn't find any.
Oh no.
Yeah, no. We're not dealing with that issue. And that was partly my problem when I came to, as a Mormon, I believe that Mary had Jewish ancestry. I could trust the research because none of these people would go into a scientific career. Oh, I'm going to try and disprove the Mormon Church, you know?
No, because absolutely.
And trying to find out the truth.
It's a very, very niche topic. And, well, I'm grateful you did it personally. But yeah, you're right. I guess where the money flows, the interest flows, unfortunately. Welcome to capitalism.
That's a good thing to be conscious of in, particularly in terms of our health.
Mm-hmm. Very much so. Yeah.
Issues. But, But yeah, you asked a moment ago about, you know, the carbon dating, but also DNA technology.
Yes, yes.
And I think it's been very interesting the way it's developed. We have amazing technology today.
Yeah.
But in terms of understanding human origins with DNA, the first DNA that was really useful for doing this sort of analysis was mitochondrial DNA.
Got it.
Mitochondrial DNA is different to all of the remainder of our DNA, which is genomic, or sits on our chromosomes. Mitochondrial DNA is only passed from mother to offspring.
Ah, interesting.
When you have your mother's mitochondrial DNA, your brother has your mother's mitochondrial DNA, that sort of thing. But passed down the generations down maternal lines. The reason mitochondrial DNA was very much used in the early research on human genetics is that the mitochondrial genome is only about 13,500 base pairs of DNA.
Huh. In the 3 billion odd.
Yeah. So.
Yeah, right.
That's sort of like not even the first word in a 500-page novel.
Yeah, got it.
Tiny, tiny fraction. And it makes sense that scientists use mitochondrial DNA because the technology to study and sequence DNA was in its infancy. So sequence to get that information involved weeks and weeks of work.
Got it. And mitochondria, the powerhouse of the cell that we all learned in eighth grade.
Yeah, so mitochondria, they're a very important part of our body.
Yeah.
And they're basically our energy powerhouses in our body. But look, to be honest, for the last 20 years, scientists, they're still useful for genetic analysis in human populations. But what's really taken over in the last 20 years is we now have the sequencing of the human genome. Mm-hmm. And scientists can now sequence your genome in virtually overnight.
Interesting. Because obviously technology is caught up. We can now, evaluate the 3 billion odd letters in the genome. Yeah, interesting. That's the fascinating thing, is like how technology aligns so much with science and like where we're kind of, our trajectory is headed. Because like imagine doing that by hand, it's going to take you a lifetime.
I used to, when I was a young scientist at CSIRO, I sequenced a gene. And I think about 2 or 3 months.
That's incredible.
Lots of, nearly just isolate the DNA, purify it, send it away, and bang, you get the result back. The run on a machine is only a few hours, and you can get the information back straight away. But it's also not just the DNA technology which is advanced, it's the computing power to analyze it.
Interesting.
So if we have the technology that we have today to sequence DNA, it'll be useless because, say 30 years ago, if we had technology 30 years ago, computers would have been so useless they couldn't have handled.
No, we're still using floppy disks. We're using floppy disks, so there would be no point in.
But you've only seen a
few. No, I was a nerd in high school, in primary school even. Believe it or not, acne, having braces, wearing, this is why I had to form a sense of humor, because otherwise I had nothing going for me. Anyway, moving on. So Dr. Sutherton had sent me 6 articles and I only got through 3, and I have so many questions and comments on the 3 that I stopped at 3 because I knew otherwise this would go for 2 weeks. I've covered this a little bit on my TikTok about how we're just sort of realizing, hey, we're all a little bit Neanderthal, we're all a little bit Denisovian, we're all a little bit this, that, and the other. And so I wanted to talk about this first. And my first question is, what on earth is a super archaic?
Very, very old. Super, super
old.
So, look, some of these super archaics they're talking about could be some of the earlier skeletons. I mean, basically, the scientists have been defining different subgroups of humans, the Homo group, and all of the different relatives of ours based on the skeletal information.
Got it.
But now you can identify these groups by DNA.
DNA. Interesting. So, interesting. Fascinating.
Yeah. It's probably worth sort of stepping back and talking about what is the DNA technology that
yeah. Yep.
Yeah. So
yep.
If it's now possible to sequence or genotype just entire human gene, one individual overnight. So labs are now sequencing the genomes of thousands and thousands of individuals and then comparing them. So, but as what we're now learning is that human ancestry is really messy. It wasn't just...
Yep.
It wasn't linear. So there were, you picture a tree. It's a tree with many dead branches in it. Quite a long time ago, and some of them died fairly recently. And Homo sapiens, the species that we belong to, is just one of those surviving branches.
Gotcha. I mean,
there are a lot of other branches that have died out before us.
Various reasons, yeah.
Various reasons.
Interesting.
And the super archaics are basically the ancestor of us,
denisovans, and a bunch of Neanderthals.
And there might be another one out there. I don't know. It's unlikely because scientists now don't even need to. To some extent, they can identify an ancestral population in the genomes we have today. Say, oh, there's something here coming from somewhere else we don't understand.
Gotcha. Because I did notice in this study that it did speak about a mystery. A mystery super archaic that we're not necessarily aware of. We don't have any evidence of necessarily yet, which is fascinating. But I guess what's more fascinating is, yeah, like you said, the technology. I did a very quick video the other day on tooth enamel studies and how they're taking DNA from tooth enamel and how reliable that is. And then also like a 5 million year old, what they assume was a Neanderthal, I don't know what you call it, maybe like civilization or like area where they lived, and the hunter gathering and them taking down a mammoth and the, you know, all that sort of thing. And I guess this is sort of like opening our minds up to, yeah, where humans or Homo sapien, is it Homo sapien sapien? Sometimes I say that and... It's not really...
No, okay.
Yes. Well, modern humans, you know, they found these very, very old projectiles with a very, very old burial of a Homo sapien. And there's a hypothesis floating around that that's potentially how we, I guess, outlived them.
It's so messy that, like, you even when you say Neanderthals, you can't just assume they're all... the same. Neanderthals inhabited huge areas of Europe across Asia. So they've even identified that they're almost subgroups of Neanderthals.
Oh, right.
No, there's no hard and there's no boundaries here.
No hard rule,
obviously, saying, no, once you're a Denisovan, you don't mix with anything else. That's it, you know.
Which isn't the case.
Yeah. So basically you get these periods of separation of populations. If they're long, those populations will become quite distinct. Mm-hmm. If they're very long, then those populations won't be able to mate.
Right.
So there's periods where they're separated, they come back together, there's mating, then they're separated and come back together.
And when we're talking about those periods, are we talking like 500,000 years, a million years? Like how long does it take for them to not be mateable? Do you know?
Definitely in the high hundreds of thousands of years, I would think.
Gotcha. Okay.
Humans were capable of interbreeding with Neanderthals.
Mm-hmm.
And know that Neanderthals and Denisovans interbred.
Yeah.
In fact, I know for a fact that I have 1.89% Neanderthal DNA.
Got it.
But I also have 0.18%, so 10% less DNA of Denisovan.
Interesting.
So we know that humans So those groups have been separated, so, you know, for probably almost a million years.
Yeah,
they're still able to.
And am I right in thinking that prior to the advancement of DNA studies, we just assumed that those subgroups could not mate?
There was speculation around that. In fact, I was aware of some of the literature on Neanderthals. There was quite a bit of speculation that Neanderthals had perhaps mated with humans. There were many that didn't believe it.
Yeah.
I would say the evidence, because they relied on skeletal evidence, you don't have many skeletons, and so it's hard to really prove beyond any doubt.
No, but DNA, obviously, that's
DNA like absolutely nails it straight away.
Yeah, absolutely. Interesting. That's fascinating.
So what I didn't send you, which was fascinating, was and I'll send you a copy after we've chatted.
Yeah, great. Yeah.
Is that they've sequenced the genome of an individual who has a Neanderthal father and a Denisovan mother.
Ah, I remember having a phone call about this. Yes. And the offspring was viable.
Yeah.
Obviously, yeah. Which is fascinating. Okay. My simple mind goes to like donkeys. So a donkey, obviously, when produced, is barren to produce more offspring, as far as I'm aware, which I assume is what maybe we thought for a little bit about humans. Like if a Neanderthal and a Denisovan were the mother and the father and then their offspring, maybe they like that was like a dead tree branch, as you would say. But obviously that's not the case at all. It's more that's our origins.
The fact that we're carrying DNA of Neanderthals and Denisovans does suggest that, yeah, offspring survived.
Mm-hmm.
But it's more than likely, given the amount of DNA that's there, that the amount of interbreeding was fairly sort of on the fringes of a large population of Homo sapiens.
Sure.
On the fringes where they interact.
Sure.
Populations, that's where there would be some sort of interbreeding.
Got it. So like the edgier ones of both societies were like, oh, yeah, you know. Yeah, got it. Interesting.
It seems it doesn't, because they've identified, when they sequenced the Neanderthal genome, they clearly sequenced what they had, the first Neanderthal mitochondrial DNA.
Sure.
Okay. Now, in all of the sequencing of humans, they'd never discovered a Neanderthal DNA mitochondrial genome. Living humans.
Huh.
Okay. So that suggests that there was mating.
Yeah.
There was may have been the DNA from Neanderthals that we carry today came in with probably a Neanderthal male mating into a human population.
Yes, gotcha. So potentially, yeah, the father was Neanderthal, the mother was Homo sapien.
Be raised in the Homo sapien community.
Interesting. And this is a very specific nerdy question, but it just popped in. If we look at a mitochondria from a Neanderthal or a Denisovan versus a modern Homo sapien, do they look and function differently? Like, how different were we really, you know?
Yeah. Well, let me see. I think the average, like the mitochondrial genome's only got about 13,500 base pairs.
So okay.
The number of differences between the average, say, Caucasian,
yeah,
be something like 10 or 15 differences.
Oh, got it. Okay, got it. Yeah.
Caucasian and, say, an African, there might be 20 or 25, so they'd be more.
Gotcha.
More distantly related. Homosexuals have more differences. But the Neanderthal one might have 60 or 70 or 80.
Yes, got it.
It's clearly well outside the range.
And Denisovan of human,
further. But in terms of the function of those genes, mitochondrial genomes have encode for about, I think it's about 40 genes.
Interesting.
And it's probably wouldn't there wouldn't be terribly many differences in there that would make much of a difference
over yeah a
period of time, but there may be
interesting
some.
Yeah, interesting. Fascinating.
What is really particularly interesting is that in when they sequenced the genomes of people living at high elevation in Mongolia, they found that they carry, there's a particular gene that they carry which helps them to survive in low oxygen environments.
Right.
That gene, is actually, I think, I might correct me if I'm wrong later on when I find out what the true answer is. I think it might be a Denisovan gene.
Because that was my next question is, when we're talking about Neanderthal, like, okay, let's go back a million odd years ago. The Denisovians, as I understand it, were much taller, much stockier, and survived in the colder environments. Is that correct? Yeah, so they come from, like, the mountainous-ish, I guess, as much as we're aware.
Eastern Asia, I think. Yeah,
Got it.
No, Neanderthal were very all the way across large areas of Eurasia, but I don't think we know enough about where the Denisovans were as accurately. We know the first Denisovan that was sequenced was in a cave just north of Mongolia, so it's in Russia, but the cave in the Altai region.
Yeah, interesting. This is a side note, which is so fascinating when you look at history and mythology and from mythology into religion and all these like stories that we pass down orally or written, and like our concept of potentially just very natural things happening, like a different species or whatever, and like the myths that we then kind of cultivate to explain those sorts of things when we didn't have, you know, microscopes and stuff.
Well, I mean, there's been a bit of a couple of hundred year fight between science and religion over many issues. There, a lot of those fights have settled down between many.
They have, yeah. But in saying that, you know, having a mill or whatever on TikTok, I still get it. I do still get it. You know, I'll post a find that's, you know, 50 million years or probably more like 500,000 years old, and they'll be like, the world's only 7,000 years old. And I'll be like, you do you, love, you do you.
Well, yeah, I was sort of in that, was in that camp for a while.
Yeah. Okay, study two, which is the interbreeding among ancient human groups and the archaeological puzzles that were solved in regards to not just, obviously, and we've actually been through this, but just to cover it because I've got it on my notes, Neanderthals and Homo sapiens and Denisovians and Homo sapiens were not the only ones to breed, but Denisovians and Neanderthals were able to interbreed, and there are questions and unknowns and mysteries surrounding other, I guess, as you put it, dead branches of different types of subgroups. One that comes to mind is the Indonesian.
On the island of Flores?
There was a very, very like small race, yeah, that thrived for I'm not sure how long, which is just another, you know, like you said, it's not a clear-cut thing. It's a very intermixed, messy, you know.
I don't think there's any DNA evidence on that front to...
Got it.
I think it's called the Hobbit.
Yeah, I think so. I've read Hobbit and Pygmy. I just don't know if that's politically correct or not, but...
It's fascinating, but... This isn't... You know, this is the way sort of evolution works. There have been very many hominid species that have, you know, evolved and become quite capable and moved out of Africa, because that's where that seems to be the origin of most of these species that moved out, and they've got into Asia, and but nothing stopped them. They've just moved.
Yeah.
Migrating.
A side question. I've heard, and I don't know anything about this, but I have heard that there's a lot of debate around the out of Africa theory. What does that mean? Can you give any context to that?
Well, I think in amongst the vast majority of scientists, that's settled.
Got it.
An old debate. But yeah, the out of Africa theory is basically that all humans, Homo sapiens now we're talking about, descend from a common ancestral group in some part in Africa.
Gotcha.
And then the alternative is the multi-regional hypothesis, where the living humans today are basically descended from groups that lived all over the.
Got it. Which, I mean, like, if we're talking about millions of years ago, I just wanted to know what was going on, because people would say things and it just sort of like went over my head, because I've never actually looked it up. So I thought I'd give that question.
The consensus, pretty much the consensus today, is that human Homo sapiens evolved as a group.
Yeah.
By about 200 to 250,000 years ago in Africa.
Got it.
Around about 180,000 years ago, they had migrated into the sort of the Middle Eastern area.
Yeah, yeah.
Australian Aboriginals are descended from a very early group.
Yeah.
From there, so they went through India, down into Malaysia, and then they crossed into Australia about 60,000 years ago.
Got it. Yeah.
There were further migrations into Australia.
Yeah, okay.
Mostly, but then Australia, because a lot of these ice ages are the thing that really had a big human migration around the world.
Sure.
Raising sea levels, that affects sea levels. And so that affects how humans can migrate. And that affected human migration into Europe quite a lot.
Of course.
So when humans moved into Europe around about 40,000 years ago, there was some very severe ice age which wiped out a lot of populations or forced them south. And I think Neanderthals sort of became extinct.
Uh-huh.
I think around the time when there was probably a lot of this cold climatic pressure really exerting itself.
Yeah, interesting. That's fascinating. Which actually leads us perfectly into the third study, which is on, and I picked this because obviously I'm half, you know, half Māori. But I picked this one, the study number 3, the Pacific Islanders and the human dispersal of and our misunderstanding of where our modern day Pacific Island peoples kind of came from. And just to give like a little quick synopsis, and I won't go on for too long, but I have obviously got we call it the whakapapa, which is like our ancestry, but we've got our history is oral. So I had an interview with my great uncle because my nan's passed away, and he was talking about just a few different stories, and my science and inquisitive brain kind of like, ooh, that's interesting. That's interesting. I think I read a study about that. Really? And so I just kind of was matching sort of what he was telling me in that cultural sense to what I guess I've read recently in scientific finds and things like that. So when you send this paper through, I was like, what, woof, which is a good thing, by the way. And I guess there is this common ideology that we came on wakas or canoes 1300 AD, which a lot of Pacific Islanders will rebut. And I felt like this study kind of showed, yeah, it's not as clean cut as that.
And I think the paper you're referring to is where they've looked at the genomes of living Pacific Islanders, I think in Samoa and Tonga.
Yeah.
And they've compared their genomes to ancient Native
Americans. Okay.
Years old. Yeah. So I got interested in Pacific Island, the ancestry of Pacific Islanders, because as you would know, Tanika, you believe you're probably taught that your ancestors came from the Americas and they were Jewish.
Yeah. And Hagoth And for the non-Mormons,
yeah,
there's a story in the Book of Mormon that talks about a fair-skinned but righteous individual. I think it was Hagoth, maybe?
Hagoth, I think,
yeah, who took a boat and for some reason Polynesians were taught that was their descendant, so they were therefore the Lamanites, which are a group of people in this book, novel, fanfic, I don't know what you want to call it. So yeah, my whole upbringing, I was taught that I was in fact a Lamanite. So that is the shared
American.
Yeah, and yes, exactly, descended from, exactly, Native Americans.
It's not only Mormons that have believed that, because there was a pretty famous guy named Thor Heyerdahl.
Okay.
Sort of an early explorer. I wouldn't call him a scientist. He wasn't very scientific. He had his own theories, and he was pushing those theories very strongly. So he sailed to quickly tell you his story. He built a big raft in South America. Because the currents aren't very helpful, he got towed off the coast for about 60 kilometers until he could then sail into the Pacific. Now, he did sail into the Pacific.
Okay.
He made it to the Tuamotu Islands, which you probably know.
Okay,
it was a long way. It was a big journey.
Pretty impressive, yeah, righto.
That was proved. He believed that the American Indians were the ancestors of
Paul Sam.
Now, that makes sense. It's fairly easy to see why people would believe that, because American Indians are descended from Asian ancestors. Polynesians are descended from Asian ancestors, right?
Got it.
So modern science has found that Polynesians are not descended largely from American Indians. They're descended from a group that, an indigenous group that appears to have originated in Taiwan and in the northern Philippines.
Interesting.
Yeah. So it was about 300,000 years ago that these were starting to develop, and one of the key technologies that they had, which you know all about, is the outrigger canoe.
Mm.
Outrigger canoes, and they were huge. Some of these were very big.
Yeah. Yeah.
Very, very stable, and you could take a lot of things on them. You could take plants and animals, families, and you could undertake big migrations. So the ancestors of the Polynesians 3,000 years ago were the best sailors in the world.
Yeah, yeah.
Unsurpassed. They were just amazing. They knew how to they learned how to sail, to recognize islands in the distance from the cloud patterns.
Yeah, star alignments.
Stars.
Yeah.
They knew how to, the sails on their outriggers were very well designed. They could tack very effectively, so they could sail close to the wind. Well, there's a whole pile of other things I don't know about in terms of their expertise, but they were supremely skilled at sailing. Now, it was only within a few hundred years of these populations emerging in the northern Philippines and Taiwan area that they sailed very quickly. Rapidly, only over a few hundred years, skirting the northern coast of Papua New Guinea and parts of Micronesia, and then colonized Samoa and Tonga.
Interesting.
2,500 to 3,000 years ago, they'd colonized those areas.
Which is so fascinating, because the oral history points to that backdating. For example, my uncle would, in this, again, it's very poetic the way that the oral history is handed down.
Yeah.
And in Maori culture, you have your mountain and your lake. Yeah, your lake. That's, I guess, your landmarks to like identify where you're from, whatever. And the oral history for the mountain, in which I forget the name of, because sorry, Uncle David, my bad. But the oral history was that Maui used his hook and pulled up that mountain, and there was an age given to it. And they let a bunch of geologists in, and they studied all the they do what geologists do, and they proved that, yeah, this mountain is at least 6,000 years older than what we originally assumed. So it's fascinating to me, you know, you look at, and each Polynesian island has a very different way of, similar but different. Like, I would never, like, I never assume if someone's Tongan or Samoan because it's very offensive when you get it wrong. I guess a sacred role it was to be the person that carries that history, and how important history really was to the community. But then two, I guess there is this concept of like, oh, well, how could they have built ships of that caliber? Well, there's a science, you know what I mean? Which is fascinating.
It does really support what science had pretty much already knew. There's quite a well-developed, I mean, you probably know about Lapita pottery. It's called Lapita pottery, and it's got very distinctive designs. Construction.
Got it.
Developed by the earliest Polynesians, and quite a few, anywhere where you see this Lapita pottery is a clear sign that those people are descended from the earliest. So that was used to connect them. But also, the history of the colonization of the Pacific is only over 3,000 years. That's a short enough period of time for the languages to be linkages. So there are clear links all the way up into the northern Philippines with languages. So they can make those links. But the most fascinating thing that was found in that particular paper that we're talking about now is a sequence of the genome of an ancient Samoan, living Samoan. And what they found was that the ancient Samoan was purely Polynesian. The living Samoan was something like about 75% Polynesian and about 25% Micronesian. Micronesia are the islands of like Papua New Guinea, Vanuatu, and the...
Like French Polynesia, we'd consider that today.
No, that's not Polynesia. That's
full. Oh, okay.
On the eastern islands in the Pacific is Micronesia, and I don't know all of the names of the country. I'm a bit ignorant there.
Yeah, no, that's okay.
So what that suggests is that the ancestors of the Polynesians got out into the Pacific very quickly. They hadn't spent years, centuries interbreeding with the populations nearby. Okay. So they would have landed on the beaches in Papua New Guinea, for example, but they may not have had much interaction with the Papua New Guineans before they sailed further on. And it's possible some of these interactions were quite hostile, so they thought, okay, we've got to get the hell
out of here. Interesting.
The fast train hypothesis, I think the freight train or the fast train hypothesis is getting out of the Pacific really quick.
Yeah.
What it suggests is that over the next 2,000 to 3,000 years, there's been mixing between the islands, okay? So there's been a longer period of mixing between the Polynesians and the Micronesian populations
interesting. Yeah.
The fact that they seem to have found good evidence of American Indian DNA in the easternmost populations in the Pacific.
Interesting. Very interesting coming, I guess, from that cultural sort of side of things and hearing all this stuff growing up and then obviously looking at studies done. And there's a lot of science that Polynesian, like you mentioned the language, like Palangi versus Pakia, like Palangi in Samoa is white person, Pakia in Terio is white person. It's very similar, you know, like.
Yeah.
And yes, it's quite fascinating to kind of see science backing up oral historians. And I think, like, just as maybe a conclusive note, like, hearing the history and, I guess, listening, it could potentially open up hypotheses for emerging scientists to be like, maybe there's something in that. I'm going to go try to back that up. You know what I mean? Like, if they get the chance to. Because it would be fascinating to just sort of take what we've been saying for generation upon generation upon generation, again, sacred roles within tribes that have, I guess, like, you know, just this one study there you go, like 3,000 years ago versus 1,200 AD. So like that brings history back a full 1,200 years, which is incredible and aligns much closer to what I guess my minimal knowledge of the spoken or oral history is.
Well, that's I mean, DNA is complementing lots of different histories.
What's
being used is to determine the ancestry of people in the British Isles. You know, there were waves of colonization into Britain. So now they're seeing the genomes of people all over the UK.
Yeah.
They're detecting a little bit of Roman influence, but they're also detecting waves of Normans coming in. It is a very, very powerful tool, DNA, but it's most effective when it complements and works alongside the other areas of science.
Yeah.
So important. And it's been particularly useful in the Pacific, I think, because so much, really the history is quite well known. A lot of questions, but you want to throw it out and ignore all the science. But for those of us who trust science and...
It's a marriage of... I feel like that's the thing is, you know, like, and not just in the Pacific, but like worldwide, we, you know, like you mentioned, Britannia, like the various tribes, like so many intricate details in the history. And even, you know, I have a friend from Latvia and she took me through just like a 101 of the tribal conflicts and things like that in the north, which I was completely unaware of. And there's so many similarities. And I feel like DNA is such a conclusive way, a very like straightforward way to be like, yeah, this happened because here's the evidence. And it's beautiful to see various cultures being able to, I guess, reclaim that science or be like, we told you guys, we told you, you know.
In some ways, you know, you've probably heard the expression, history is written by the survivors.
Yes.
There is a bit of an element to that with DNA because if you have a population that moves in and wipes out another population, we may not have much of that.
Of course.
I mean,
yes.
It may be discovered eventually with work on remains, but we may not see much of their DNA in...
the living population. Yep.
Into they never mated, so.
Yeah, interesting. Which I guess also speaks to, because I often get questions like, how do you feel about digging up dead people? And I'm like, well, if it's done with respect and like an actual desire to learn more about where we come from and give voice to history, then, you know, it's very important. And there's like, I feel like, honestly, there's new technology every day and I'm like, they do what now? They can do radioluminescent x-ray blah 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 on a tooth enamel and find out that they existed, you know? So
eight.
It's fascinating. And it's just exactly. Anything else you wanna add before we close up? And it's been a pleasure.
We probably have to put a fist into
me. I'll talk underwater if you let me. It has been such a pleasure. I can't wait. This will probably come out in about a week's time and I'll send you what my editors have done with it. But yeah, Dr. Southerton, you can buy his, if you Google him.
I hang around the ex-Mormon community.
Oh, yeah, he does.
Pop up from time.
Yeah. I mean, that's how we met. Thank you to John DeLynn for connecting us. But yeah, let me know in the comments your questions. We'll definitely do a part two, I think, because there's going to be a lot of questions. I can just feel it in my waters. And thank you so much for your time. It's been awesome.
Yeah. It's been fun.
Okay. Yeah. And I'll read the other three studies, I swear.
And I'll send you another 10.
Yeah, amazing. All right. Thanks, Simon. You're amazing. And we'll see you next time.